will discover that the Bible study of agenda is maybe not quite like what you're used to seeing under the label Bible study. It's sort of a mixture of a lot of different things, and it might, every now and then I'll say something about what seems to me to be the Bible study agenda, the task that needs doing in conjunction with Bible study. Not every Bible study does the whole agenda, and this doesn't. And the Bible is a resource that is not easily exhausted, so that there's room for all kinds of Bible study. But it might help you follow my... Unfortunately, I'm not like a superhighway. I'm more like Railroad Creek. And I trickle and babble along and curve around here and go around there. And I think the Bible is a little bit like that too. But it is, sometimes you do need some markers along the way. So Bible study is not... Dig is not simply digging up nuggets which are already refined and processed and ready to be displayed on necklaces and altars. There is a job of translation that is integral to the process of the Bible fertilizing the life of our world. There is a kneading that needs to be done if the Bible leaven is going to raise the lump. You see, all of these images, notice Bible as leaven, Bible as light, not Bible as whole, not Bible as box, not Bible, okay. Bible as salt, there needs to be a certain amount of shaking. If you put too much salt, try a diet of pure salt someday, will you?
No.
That's not what salt is for. Okay, so Bible as some kind of translation. Meaning is not there's something, how about it? When you look at the music, when you look at notes on a page, you say, well, that's the notes, but you know music is something else. You know, somebody has to play the notes to make the music. When you think about meanings, you keep the meaning sort of tied to the book, as though the meaning and the book were the same thing. Actually, words in a book are the script which enable human beings to make meanings. When they imagine, internalize, translate the words in the book. You know, meaning is a living phenomenon that has something to do with words and contexts, with what people hear and do with what they hear, and isn't just the text for the meaning. If for those of you who are interested in theory, my way I put it is meaning is T plus C, meaning is text plus context. Never simply text. And for those of you who want to, that's a whole other discussion. So there is involved a translation process, which part of which has as its task the bringing into living language of that which comes and is conserved by the texts of the past. Another aspect of this translation is that language is always on the move. Language is always on the move. It may move so slowly as a glacier, so you think it's the same place it was yesterday. But it isn't the same place as it was yesterday. I mean, to give you the big, bold example, it has to do with the translation of 1 Corinthians 13. At the 17th century, charity was a wonderful word, caritas. It was a wonderful word that had to do with a concern, personal and social, that was sort of oriented to human need. There was no chance of mixing up charity and the erotic. There was no possibility of mixing up charity and affection. It had its own word, and it was very clear. Charity in the 20th century came to mean a kind of paternalistic form of helping people, other people. And so it completely lost its capacity to say what charity, to translate the 1 Corinthians 13 as charity had translated it. And so the King James translation of 1 Corinthians 13 remains, it's something like Handel's Messiah. You know, it remains an absolutely eloquent, beautiful statement, except that nobody understands what charity is anymore. Or charity doesn't mean charity anymore. The word charity now doesn't mean that, so it's like singing Italian opera in Italian. You get the music, but you don't hear the words, and so it's all that. So you've got to translate. So there is always a drift. In the language. So that anytime you find it in the Bible, it's one generation old. So that one of the tasks of Bible study is to coin the metaphors which convey the sense of the text and get it out of the language which has frozen. And I talked last week a little bit about the frozen metaphors. In other words, metaphors that used to be knives or sparks, but have turned into charms, you know, have turned into decorations. That's one of the things, we paper our walls with dead metaphors, and instead of metaphors warming, striking, evoking, they cover. And so there's somehow some of the words we can rebirth, and we keep the same word. For example, one of the words that this Isaiah 6 is about the word call, and that's a funny word. And basically, whenever you do Bible study, keep asking yourself now. What is this text all about? What is going on here that I have seen happen? Now, you can go too far with that question, but it's worth asking if you know when to put the brakes on. That I've seen happen and know something about what's going on in this text and how do we talk about it? Call. Well, there are telephone calls, and they're a damn nuisance half the time. Call. There is a whole theology of call that instead of using the, and there were some very important insights in that topic in theology, but it used the word call to clarify a lot of things, but now when people use talk theology of call, much of the time they are not using the word call to illumine our experience. They're trying to get our experience to fit into that categories. And so the word call gets all funnied. When I hear the word call, I think more of of being drafted than being invited, for example. And if you look at this text, I mean, one of the really surprises, one of the great surprises of this text, and it says, in fact, one of the points of this text is that maybe you don't have a call. Not just that everybody has the same call. One of the great surprises, and I just didn't, you know, I've gone to church a long time. And usually, one of the diseases, I think it's a disease. I mean, it starts out because we're all trying to be helpful and we want to share what we have been given. But one of the diseases in the church is that we all lay on other people our trips. I mean, it's something like saying, you've got to sleep because God has given me this wife, you've got to sleep with her or something. Because God has given me this experience, you've got to have the same kind of experience as I do. There is a great laying on of our God encounter on other people. Instead of saying, because I had a God encounter and it had so much to do with my guts that it is completely unrepeatable, go find your own God encounter. You know, we keep saying, well, it happened to me this way, I'm sure it's going to happen to you that way. So what I'm saying is, most of the time I have grown up, the word call has been associated with some pattern that somehow I ought to fit into. Either that I ought to be a Christian, or that I ought to be a preacher, or that I ought to be putting myself on the line for this cause. And there was a great, well, it's just a word, basic premise. Words have connotations and denotations. The word says something, and then as it's used, it picks up all kinds of reverberations that often speak louder than what the word says. So you can hear the word love and feel exploited. And you can hear the word call and feel coerced. And the interesting thing about Isaiah's call is that it's very peculiarly Isaiah. Ezekiel, if you want to see two interdependent calls, Ezekiel's call plays upon Isaiah, but if Isaiah is done with a oboe, Ezekiel's is done with strobe lights and electric guitar and just, you know. There is a connection between the two, but you have to look very hard to see it. And poor little Amos's call, it's nothing so musical and grand. It's the roar of a lion is his metaphor. And some of them don't even have calls. Imagine getting your stuff in the Bible and not having had a call worth talking about. You know, they don't bother to tell you that, you know, you can find calls here and here and here, but you don't find them in this book and this book and this book. And there's something, and the other thing about Isaiah's call, it's very particular. The other thing about Isaiah's call is that it's, Isaiah actually volunteers. Isaiah doesn't get sort of the way the story works out is he stumbles into the God scene and hears God says that he needs somebody. And Isaiah volunteers. It wasn't a big lay on at all. It's a good thing he did because he got a dirty job to do. And you know, you have a much, much better motivations if people choose dirty jobs than if they get assigned dirty jobs. You know that. I mean, when you get that really nitty-gritty, nasty job, you don't tell your kids. you say, well, now, who is strong enough to do this? that sort of thing. So it's a very different, it's a call story that completely shattered all my preconceptions of calls, in other words. It's a call story that sort of got my bag of call images. I guess that's the way to put it. There's a word and then there's a bunch of images around it. It completely rearranged the images that I connected with call. We've talked a little. Basically, I've thought of the simplest I think that the simplest term for call is clarification. A call is a clarification of how your agenda and the God agenda for the world intersect. And there are any number of kinds of calls, but prophecy. What's a prophet? What do you think of? What do you think of when you think of the word prophet? Just all kinds of that's a word that has all kinds of luscious. What do you think of when you think of the word prophet?
He's someone who speaks forth for God.
All right, that's a good trend. The word pro means to speak forth or on behalf of. The word fate comes from the phemi and means to speak. So a prophet is somebody who represents or speaks for. What would be the simplest translation of that? What is the common word for somebody who talks out about something?
Preach.
A perfectly legitimate, normal translation for prophet is preacher. Not preacher as a vocation in the church, but preacher as someone who's giving a message. I mean, whether it be a play, there are a lot of plays that preach. There are a lot of politicians that preach. There are a lot of community organizers that preach. There's a lot of, you can run into them in almost any business. Somebody who has a message laid on them and really is one way or another kind of spreading a message as they go about their job.
And Alan Cryer.
What?
Alan Cryer.
That's a stunning image because originally the form of the prophet owes much to the ancient world's version of a town crier. Many of the prophetic oracles are messenger oracles. In the ancient world, they didn't have, you know, wireless, and they didn't have TV, and they didn't have as ample paper and pencil. If you were wealthy, if you were a king or a very rich person, you would dictate your message to them, and they would trot and say, here's the message from Cyrus, king of Persia, quote, I, Cyrus, so-and-so and so-and-so. And that's that messenger oracle form is how you got these people into talking from God in the first person. It probably is not that they were off their rocker and came out of a trance and thought they were God for 5 minutes. But it's mostly that the form in the ancient world, which best expressed their relationship to God, was the form of the messenger carrier, the form of the letter carrier. And so if they wanted to show that they were carrying a message for God, they would do the messenger oracle form. Town crier, there's a wonderful, there's an oracle in the end part of Isaiah on watchmen, watchmen, and there's a wonderful Ezekiel oracle at the watchmen. Many of these prophets got, their job turned out to be waking people up. Basically trying to alert them to crises, that both political, social, and religious crises. And so the image of the watchman who stood up on the walls and would announce the people that were coming, he would announce the dawn, he would announce fire, he would announce the enemy. Without the we don't even have extras from the newspaper anymore because we hear it all on the television, you know. So that we don't have that sense of a person doing it. I think in some ways somebody like Isaiah was a fairly noble level of rearing, an aristocrat. It's very interesting. You get a wonderful contrast between Isaiah and Micah and Hosea and Amos are both Northerners. Amos is from the south, but he bombs up to the north and is so shook up by the rough things of the city that he really gets fired up. And Hosea is a guy with what one would call a rough marriage. And out of that comes what he has to say. And Micah, what you got to get between Micah and Isaiah, and it's too good to wait for another Bible study. O thou Bethlehem, the least of all the cities of Judah. Now, what you're really talking about, you see, Micah is, Isaiah is a royalist, pure and simple. If there's a Jesus if there's a new king that's coming, he's going to be coming out of David's line, and David is Zion and Jerusalem. He's a New Yorker. He's a Washingtonian. He's from Rome. There's none of this rusticness. But Micah says, well, don't forget that David was born in Bethlehem. He was born out in the country. I was born out in the sticks. So that there's a beautiful urban-rural tension between the way Micah talks. And his language is less finished and more down to earth images. And Isaiah is talking like a beautiful Jerusalem aristocrat. And both of them made it. Both of them made it into the collection. In many ways, the image that sort of clarifies is it's a kind of vulnerable position. But you almost think about Isaiah as part of the king's cabinet. There's somebody and interestingly enough, that's sort of if you want an image of a prophet, it's somebody who sort of is like a secretary of state carrying the messages of a president. It's somebody who is in some sense carrying God's agenda and confronting his people with God's agenda. Now, there are all sorts of prophets are motley crew. It's very important that you recognize that in the Bible the word is used both descriptively and normatively. Moses is called a prophet. These groups of prophets, there's a lot of variety to it, so just as there is to preaching and so on. Historically, this is one way to think of it, that remember those stories of Samson and Deborah and those judges? Before there was stable government before there was national government in Israel, every now and then there was somebody who had to put the act together and raise the army and solve a problem, and so there were episodic, or as the technical term is, charismatic leaders. They were leaders that didn't inherit their job, but they just got sort of picked out of the wind, or picked out of the blue. And God can really work either way. He's fairly flexible. That's important to realize. God's had a lot of experience with lots of kinds of people and lots of countries and a long history of this earth. And he is give him a little credit for being a little bit shrewd, will you? Don't just think he hits his head against the wall for no purpose. So that there are these judges, and they would get the war going, and they would help organize things, and they would give oracles. Well, now, when they got to have kings, the kings took over a lot of the things that these charismatic leaders did, and they developed the national order. What the kings couldn't take over is this kind of provoking voice trying to break open the issues and challenges of the time. They simply could not, when you have to keep the shop going, there, at a certain point in the development of human society, there is differentiation. And so tasks split, and there is a split off, and the prophet becomes a kind of figure all by himself. Now, some of them were great. Now there's a wonderful story of Nathan in I think it's 2 Samuel, and he walks into the king and he tells a parable that sounds to all the world like a parable of Jesus. Jesus really studied the Old Testament. He didn't get it all out of his head or all out of his God consciousness. He really got a good bit of his repertoire for understanding God and for his message out of the Old Testament. And it's for that reason that people who would be Christians really need to know something about the Old Testament. You just take the Jesus disciple bit in so many weird directions if you don't understand the Old Testament that it's just important. And if you haven't read the Old Testament lately, please get going and start getting complicated. Nathan comes into David and he tells, and it was the job of, they would come in and present cases to the king and the king would decide him, so he comes in, and this was just after David's thing with Bathsheba, and he says, you know, here was this rich man, and he had lots of sheep and he got company and he took the poor lamb from his neighbor who only had one lamb, and he used that to feed his company instead of killing one of his own sheep, you know. And David says, my goodness, what a nasty guy. He ought to be killed, you know, for being that exploited. Very interesting. I'm sure that all of us think that what was wrong with David was his hormones. And what Nathan thought, if Nathan is any judge, what Nathan thought was wrong with David was that he was behaving like a rich, exploitive lord and not playing fair with his general and with his people. So Nathan turns around and says, you're the person. That's you. That's you. So the prophet, it's a wonderful illustration of the prophet as the one who held up the mirror to the king. Showed the king what he was really like. And in a way, you know, all this thing of knowing who's a prophet, you know when the prophecy has been laid on you because you find so much out about yourself that you didn't really want to know. I mean, that's one of the tests. When they tell you the truth that you don't want to hear, I mean, there are other things that prophets say. You know, there are other tests. But that's one really sure one. And then there was Elijah and Elisha. And Elisha has a good collection of stories, but he's probably a follower up to Elijah. Elijah took on the kings and had this strong confrontation with the Baal tradition that we have in that wonderful story of the remnant of, in that wonderful story on Mount Horeb, and then Mount Carmel, right? And then Elijah goes off into the wilderness, almost plays Moses, and he gets to Mount Horeb. And what happened to Moses at Mount Horeb? That story, of course, was thunder and lightning and Ten Commandments and the real whole manifesto for the reorganization of the people of Israel. And Elijah gets to Mount Horeb, and the earthquake comes and goes, and the thunder comes and goes. Lo and behold, he doesn't hear anything until there's just a tiny small voice. And all it says, instead of Elijah turning into the great, you know, Elijah was going to be the new founder, new Messiah, new founder, a renewer of the whole covenant. And instead of it turning into that, in essence, the Mount Horeb oracle is go on back and finish the job. You sneaked off before you finished it, so go on back and do the rest of it. And it's kind of a come down. I mean, sometimes when you get a good prophetic, maybe God only gives you one good prophetic blast in your whole lifetime. And you know, and to keep trying to do that act over again when you haven't got it, you know, that's hard on you, and it's probably confusing to God, and you know, just oracles, after all, are oracles, and God trips finally are laid on you, and you kind of have to wrestle through, and just leave. I suppose what I think what's so great about the Isaiah call is that there's some space for God to be free in the whole thing, and there's some space for Isaiah to be free in the whole thing. God and Isaiah are not acting, either one of them, like puppets, or like words in an ideology, or like some symbols in a religion. There's a certain kind of freedom and autonomy and mystery about how it's going to come out that isn't collapsed, and it's really good to wonder what God wants to do with you sometimes instead of know all the answers. Because probably if you know exactly the answers, it's somebody else's God trip that you just haven't gotten over yet. Not always, but fairly often. Okay, incidentally, and let me put this down on the table for the week, and I may not get around to talking about it till Friday, but think about it, you know. These prophets, the Isaiah bunch now, are the writing prophets, and Isaiah is an anthology of prophetic oracles. It's just exactly like those dumb anthologies you use in English classes, where there's a collection of things. And they're poems, most of them. I mean, granted, we don't expect preachers and poets to be identical, you know. But these guys were. And I'm sure that the way they think is probably more poet than theologian, except that their poetry comes out to say some very strong theological things. But here we've got guys who are preachers, who are poets, who are provokers of insight. And so in a way, I'm asking the question, what does preaching and poetry and politics have to do with each other? Somewhere down underneath, these little sermon poems about what was going on in Israel, stand as some kind of stubborn reminder that underneath the obvious, there is some connection. There can be some connection between poetry and politics and preaching. And good luck. It's not obvious. It's not obvious. Some of the important things in life are not obvious. Okay, we got to get on with the text, and I break the text up into two. You will notice that the first half of the text is in prose, and it runs through verse 8. Second half of the text is a poem oracle. This is Isaiah chapter 6. You will also find that the two parts of this text are very different. The first one part is a scene, and the second, with some dialogue in it, The second part of it is a commission. It's a word that is laid on Isaiah, and they make good sense put together, whether they were originally written that way or not. There were some prophets who were seers. They saw things. And there were other prophets who were auditors. They heard things. And some oracles mix up seeing and hearing. Only their kind of hearing was not as dull as some of our kind of hearing. In the year that King Uzziah died, oh my, what a dull. I passed over that verse for years, that phrase for years. Do you realize that little line delivers us from all attempts to moralize this passage? This is an autobiographical exposure from Isaiah, and it's something that happened in his guts and to him in a particular time and place. And it might give you some ideas about what God wants to happen to you, but will you forever remember that this is Isaiah's call? And don't go stealing it or trying to, you know, there is a way of using the Bible which keeps making us fit into the Bible. And there's a way of using the Bible which sprinkles the Bible on our life and gives it some flavor. Now, Isaiah's call should give you some, can really prod your imagination so you learn to be more open in finding your call. But for goodness sakes, don't try to be Isaiah. All right? This is a call that was given to Isaiah in the year that King Uzziah died. Then. And it'll do you some good to think about it and to live with it, but you can't do it over again, and God doesn't need it done over again. That was done already. I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and his train filled the temple. And above him stood the seraphim, and each had six wings. With two he covered his face, and with two he covered his feet, and with two he flew, and one called to the other and said, Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, and the whole earth is full of his glory. Where's this scene? What's the scene made out of? What's the God scene made out of? Now, remember with Amos, look up Amos 3 or 4 or something like that, and you'll see a God scene made out of a lion roaring in the wilderness. The cry of a lion in the wilderness. What's this scene? What the stuff you see in the Isaiah vision. Calls, like dreams, are the rearranged components that your experience has collected. So you can talk about the material for a call. You can't talk about exactly what the call says. But you can talk, where does the material for this call come from? There are two sources of this kind of imagery. Well, what kind of, well, dreams build on material that comes from stuff you see when you're awake. I mean, you change it around in your dream, but you usually, the input that you have to make dreams out of, just like language comes from something you've heard. Now, you say your own thing, but it comes from what you've heard. And, okay, you're right on, that's both of them. In the ancient world, who was it that had a big, splendid throne room and had these big, big, beautiful cabinet meetings? It was the emperors. They didn't have such a, they didn't, well, Solomon was pretty big. They had their golden age in Israel, but certainly there were stories about the magnificent throne scenes in Mesopotamia, and magnificent throne, oh my, the Egyptians, God himself, the sun itself, and is present in the ruler. And they still don't know as much about things in Greece, and they were more sedate, but certainly from the Oriental, the two major Oriental powers in Egypt and in Mesopotamia, they had a lot of lot of images of magnificence that are associated with throne scenes. The other thing that's mixed into this is really the Holy of Holies with its altar and its presence. That funny thing on the altar, some scholars have, and I think it makes good sense, that have figured out that was a empty chair. It's empty chair. It's something like putting the empty chair at a Seder for the Messiah to come in, so that there's always room. The chair on the altar, the Lord's throne was empty, and the Lord's presence was symbolized not by a authoritative figure, but by the cloud or the fire of the presence. There are things, the smoke, of course, is incense. The chanting sounds exactly like a liturgical chant, you know, a group of priests. You know, almost sometimes in my more mischievous moments, I think that what really happened is that Isaiah fell asleep in church. And the chancel just fell down, and all of a sudden there was that symbol of God's presence sort of turned into the whole throne room, and it's just a mixture of the altar turned into the court. The altar turned into the court, and and I suppose if you want one word that whole scene is about, it's the word glory. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, the whole earth. Let me just finish that part of it. Then the foundations of the threshold shook at the voice of him who called, and the house was filled with smoke. I think one thing that one of the questions that this glory scene raises is, and there are different ways of symbolizing or imaging glory. The question it raises, that it perplexes me, and I don't really have any answer, so I just want to leave you with the question. Where has all the glory gone? Where has all the glory gone? There was a time in the Bible and in among some of my relatives that I can even remember, you know, aunts and uncles, grandaunts and people of that vintage, there was at a time a sense of the bigness, a sense of the otherness of God, a sense of the somehow majesty or glory or awe. Once in a while you run into people who have a sense of mystery left. And I don't know, I think some things, of course, I think that there were people who had a sense of glory who were trying to lay on us their sense of glory rather than to have us find and get in touch with mystery and awe. And so we had to sort of escape from, you know, I can remember where they didn't want anybody at our church, they didn't want anybody who wasn't ordained to walk inside the altar room. And because that was a holy place, you know. And there was something to that symbolism, because there's something very awesome about speaking God oracles. And we built up a dignity around the Bible so that we would get goosebumps when we heard the words before we understood any of it. But you know, there's something the matter, because you really should get the goosebumps from what's said and not just from the tone of the voice. You know, and then one day I walked around behind the altar and I discovered that it was white and gold on front, and in back it was cupboards, and that's where they kept the vacuum cleaner. And so I really discovered that their sense of glory was kind of half-baked anyhow. But you know, the burning bush story, that was real glory, and glory is not, a sense of glory is not something you can lay on people. And I used to think My, what a relief to not have that laid on you. And now I've come to the conclusion that what's happened to us is that we're living in surface images, and we don't have the imagination to come up with what I would call root images anymore. In other words, if I might put it this way, stroking is a wonderful image. You know, I like to be in touch with people too, but there's something about fire. There's something about the image of fire that worms its way down into the rock quarries and down to that those parts of myself where there really is something, not just to touch, but something to be afraid of. You know, there is at the gut level of ourselves and of the universe some mystery which is not simply domestic. There is some mystery which is not simply manageable. And once in a while it breaks out, and once in a while it waters things, but there is, and we just haven't got the we feel it. I mean, one of the things I think that's our dilemma right now is that we've got all the gut feelings, but we've got no gut images. All the images are images for the surface, so you have to sort of get your gut up to the surface before you've got a word for it. I mean, what a relief if we could just have a burning bush and not have to do a whole year of therapy or counseling or 10 seasons of Bible camp before everything broke loose for us, you know? Good heavens if we could have a burning bush. But I think something, there just aren't any fire voices or fire, I don't know. Anyhow, where has all the glory gone? So where is the fire? And thank you, Jody, for getting the fire going again, or the fire, giving us back the fire image. Jody preached a sermon last, or did a poem. He did a prophet thing last time, and it had to do with fire. Okay, the second really profound aspect of this is, woe is me, for I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips. I'm in the midst of a people of unclean lips, for my eyes have seen the King, the Lord of hosts. You see, at the gut level, I suppose one of the lessons of Isaiah's call is, don't settle. Better no call than a superficial call, huh? Okay? Not everybody has to have a big deal call. Better a good, solid, earth-shaking call that tears you apart or that really gets to your gut than an imitation one. Because you really don't need one for a lot of things. You don't even need a call to be a pastor. You need a task. Not every priest had a call. Not every preacher has to be a prophet, for goodness sakes. You know, we've only got in the Bible, we've got about a dozen prophets out of 500 years. That's not so many. Not every preacher made the grade. So for goodness sakes, don't keep imagining that you are called to be a prophet if it hasn't been laid on you, because maybe you haven't been. And for goodness sakes, say thank you. Don't borrow trouble, for goodness, you know. God, some of these nitty-gritty calls are trouble. I mean, read the end of this. Anyhow, some of the calls people have are much too superficial. This one, when Isaiah got there, I am lost, for I am a man of unclean lips. Unclean is a funny word. Unclean means when you, in modern thing, when my clothes are dirty, or when there's dirt on my jeans, or when I'm sweaty, and it just I think it's a funny word, and you have you have images of your uncle or aunt who was compulsively clean, and you know, that isn't what unclean is about. I just don't know the translation of the word unclean. I mean, that's the translation of the language, but I just don't know any good vernacular English that conveys what being unclean in the ancient world is all about. The only way I know, somebody got a...
Not being kosher, not being properly prepared.
Well, you see, kosher, look what's happened to kosher in the modern world. Kosher in the modern world has to do with the dietary laws and the ritual cleanliness. And if you look, you read that through that book of Exodus and Leviticus, and they've got a hodgepodge that includes dietary laws, so it does include, you know, attention to things like sanitation. It does have something to do with staying clean and staying free of disease. It includes moral things like the Ten Commandments. It includes the thing about how to run your services and how to build the ark. So Torah is simply the directions and counsel which make for the good life. And to be unclean is somehow to be out of joint, to somehow have something happen that has to get you back on the track. It's to be off the track. It's to be off the track. And it could be, you could spoil the service and need to get back on the track, or in those days you could have a baby and you would have to be purified and get back on the track. I mean, having a baby is something of a, it's very disconcerting. And it gets you off the normal agenda. And there is, so that being unclean, anything could sort of get you off the track, the way. In other words, Torah is the way to human existence. And it has all sorts of important big things in it, like don't kill anybody, to all sorts of totally ridiculous little things in it, like wipe your nose without spreading your germs. And so unclean, just don't oversimplify unclean. And don't identify uncleanness with sexual repression, and you know, it's a funny thing. Anyhow, Isaiah got off the track. He somehow was aware of how far he was from. He was grungy. To be unclean is to know you're grungy, to have it dawn on you. Well, you know, it's easy to know you're grungy if you've come back from Cloudy Peak or Holden Lake. But it's not so easy to know you're just grungy all the time in certain respects. And so this is what's great about this call, because he had this vision of God, and it opened up a deep sense of... Now that's terribly important, because there is an idealism laid on the task of being human, which keeps us imagining that we ought to be music or words or Greek or, you know, or statues, but doesn't allow for the normalcy of flesh and blood. You know, we keep turning ourselves into what we do rather than being flesh and blood human beings. And part of the way you get rid of that sort of icing, that ideal icing on life, is to discover the inherent grunginess of existence. So thank God when you bump into the fire and some of that, you discover that to be human is to sweat. You know, it isn't to be dry all the time. It's to sweat. And so this is a... There's something wrong with a God experience in Jewish and Christian tradition that doesn't get in touch with you, the grungy level. You know, if you only feel transported into the heavens and don't really feel like you're in touch with the earth, then you've only got half a God trip. You see, this is a double God. He had a vision of the heavens and a vision of the glory of God, But his first reaction was to break out into cold sweat and say, my goodness, I'm so far from this. You see. So if you've got the vision but not the sweat, better take another look at that vision, because something can go haywire. Okay, and then he got cleansed. Behold, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away. Your sin is forgiven. So there's a kind of healing. There's a kind of reconciliation. And then, whom shall I send, and who will go for us? I've already underlined that. Notice that there is a movement in this text from Isaiah's awareness of his own need to his awareness of God's need. And one of the things that doesn't if you are free, you are free to be needy. And if God is free, he's free to be needy. So there's something that Isaiah, as a matter of fact, answered God's need. God needed a job done. And Isaiah said, well, can I do it? Interesting. And on the one hand, you see, I've been saying that God is really quite different than us, and there's something awesome and frightening and scary about the whole bit. And then on the other thing, I'm saying, well, maybe God is really more human than we are. Maybe God isn't really, after all, as much like a parent. I keep feeling that one of the things that gets in the way of mature devotion and commitment is that the God, to put it in Gestalt terms, the God in us is always the parent voice. And we've never quite grown up, and we still think we ought to do what our parent voice tells us to do, and yet we know we have to sort of make some decisions on our own and be adult. And so we're always wobbling inside between parent and adult and child. And I guess I want to say that somewhere along in your life, you know, you've got to relate to God like adult. You've got to relate to God like adult. And on your side. That's not saying you're as big as God. That's not saying that there isn't an element of a very profound, because there is a very profound element of dependency between adults. But you know, the really dirty jobs in life take people who are not backed simply doing it because they're supposed to do it. The really dirty jobs in life take people who really are committed to do that job. You know, and profit jobs, clean up mess jobs, justice jobs, you can't use people with trite motivations, who are just in it because they think they're supposed to be in it. I mean, that won't help. You've got to be in it because you choose to be in it. So there's a lot of freedom in this text. I mean, it's disturbing. It's disturbing as anything to be confronted with the fact that some of the things that need doing, you have to choose to do. You can't just back into them and do them for a little while because you're supposed to do them, and then because you're supposed to tend to love yourself too, then you back off. There just are things to be done in this world, some very dirty jobs, and it depends on some people. It depends on some people who choose that my agenda and the God agenda intersect, and I choose to volunteer for this job. Now, that doesn't mean that you shape the whole job, you see, because All Isaiah did was volunteer. That's a big sweat. And the last thing to be said about this text, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but let me read one verse so you just can't escape it. Make the heart of this people fat and the eyes of and their ears heavy and shut their eyes that they lest they see with their eyes. This is a very crazy passage. It turns up again in Romans. It turns up again in the explanation of what parables are about. Why in the world do you have a preacher to make them not able to hear? That just blows all your preconceptions about what religion is about. You have a preacher in order to save the world. And God wants everybody to understand everything. Now, what sense does this make? Well, I'm still open. I'm still on the road on this text, but I've got two possibilities. One, and I don't think this is the one. It could be, you know, once in a while a parent says, all right, don't do that. And what you really mean is, you know, have, you know, do it. I mean, you're being clever. But I think there's another analogy that helps me with this kind of language, but I'm not sure. I'm really not sure about this. When I was younger, I used to think that parents were for preventing crises. And I don't think that anymore. Most of the important things that I have learned in my life, I have learned in crises. And most of the, and an awful lot of the real learning that my children are doing, they're not learning from my learning situations, they're learning from their own crises. So maybe, just maybe, we're not always supposed to be about preventing crises. Maybe there is a point that God reaches with a nation where the only way that they will wake up is if something happens. And maybe we will not change our priorities till we run out of oil, you know. And there is a point at which God says, all right, the only thing to do is for this crisis to run its course. Right there. Wrestle with that text. You may be able to give me a much better picture of the text, because that's one of those texts which is so curious. I mean, we just don't think that way anymore. And it's so curious in its logic that I'm not positive about how. But at any rate, at least we know that Isaiah, and we'll see tomorrow when we hear about the things he has to say about religion and the things he has to say about his country, it's quite clear that Isaiah's call was to a very nasty job about saying true things that people didn't want to hear, and just that's no kind of trip that, you know, even God didn't lay it on him, you know. God didn't just say, you've got to do that. He said, I've got this job. And Isaiah volunteers. And then the sort of nitty-gritty begins to take shape. So, all this bit about calls and identity clarification and agenda clarification, and I view a call as starting in an identity clarification and ending in an agenda clarification. All this stuff. Don't oversimplify your guts. Don't collapse the images. Get the images too small. Don't be afraid of the image and the sweat. And it is, after all, letting your agenda mixed up with God's agenda is like moving from the chair to the fire, from the frying pan to the fire. It isn't like staying in the same. So, you know. And you in this case, you don't really have to be Isaiah. But, God lays fires on people sometimes. He just does. Not the fire he laid on yesterday's, but he does lay fires on people.